Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hey everyone, this is Klaatu, and I have something a little bit different for you today. Rather than reviewing some Creative Commons or public domain content, story, or campaign setting, or pantheon, I'm talking to one of the creators of a bunch of Creative Commons content. This guy is an amazing producer of content. He comes up with some great ideas, posts them online for public domain or Creative Commons use. I discovered him through his games, the little old-school RPGs that he designs. Simple, usually, fairly, you know, they can be printed on sometimes as, you know, just one page. It's pretty amazing stuff. He's got a great single-player dungeon crawler that he created. He's just got a bunch of stuff. But in terms of creating content for other people to use, in terms of lore and fiction and that sort of creative content, his site at geekarchaeology.com, that's geekarchaeology.com. So geekarchaeology, and just remember that archaeology has literally more vowels than consonants. Archaeology. I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. But his Geek Archaeology site has two features that you absolutely just have to check out. One is Monster Mondays, where he creates a new monster on Mondays, and then another is Faction Friday, which is a fairly new thing that he's doing, but he's creating factions out of subclasses from each class in Xanathar's Guide to Everything. So he's just kind of working away at that and comes up with some great ideas. So I decided to contact him through Mastodon, the open source microblogging platform. Do we still call it microblogging? I'm not really sure. Anyway, I asked him if he wanted to be interviewed for this show, and he graciously agreed. So let's hear what he has to say. Brent, you are, from what I can tell, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, and I'm coming at you from someone who just sort of stumbled across you on the internet. You seem to be a one-man publishing house. I mean, you have so many games out there, and you have this great blog that we'll talk about in a moment. So what is your shtick? What do you do online?
So I call myself a 21st century Renaissance man. I have lots of different interests, lots of different ideas, and my shtick, is, as you so rightly put it, is that I just put it all out there. So I love tabletop role-playing games, board games, anime, manga. I'm getting back into video games after a hiatus, and so I like to talk about all that stuff, and then as I delve into those, then those all inspire each other. So, you know, I have lots of ideas for role-playing games.
And it's kind of amazing to me the number of role-playing games you've got on your little museum of curiosities or whatever you call
yes.
it. Because when I stumbled across those, I just couldn't stop going through the list and playing them at the local conventions, because it was just so easy to grab one, read it through, and then take it and just play it with a bunch of people. It's really a great resource.
I'm so glad to hear that. That is exactly the intent.
One of the interesting things about your work that certainly attracts me as a free culture geek is that it's mostly very free culture, like Creative Commons, that sort of thing, or public domain in some cases. Is that an ethical thing for you, or is it just the one that makes sense because you know that if you do that, then people will find it? Or is it a little bit of both?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. On the one hand, it's a matter of accessibility. You know, I forget what the famous quote is, that small publishers' enemy is not money, it's attention. That I need people to see my work, or I would like as many people as possible to see my work. And one of the best ways of doing that is by making it as open as possible. I also get frustrated when I'm looking around for tabletop games and I see either there's no license or it's under a very restrictive license. And I'm like, I would love to write an adventure for this. I'd love to take it apart and build something else with it. And I just don't know how to do that. But if I see that, in a CC BY or CC BY NA, I know exactly what I can do with it, and then I can go off and have fun.
Now, are you an old school RPG gamer, or how long have you been doing just the gaming side of it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So I started running tabletop games, and I started playing tabletop games back in 2001. And then I started running them, in the mid-2000s, I think. And so I was certainly for the old school environment. And I think it's one of the reasons why the whole old school renaissance or revolution, whatever you want to call it, has piqued my interest so much. Because I heard all of these stories about what it was like back in the day. And I really wanted to recapture that flavor as much as possible. The other thing is, one of the things I like to do is dig deep into a topic where, you know, I like to do the research. I like to look up the history of things.
Yeah, and you're a geek. Go figure. Yeah,
exactly. So when folks were starting to talk about the OSR and there was a lot of confusion about what the OSR actually was, I would go back and say, okay, well, let's just take first edition D&D and just go through it. And okay, this is a little confusing for me. What if I condense it down and simplified it? Or what if I wrote a little article explaining it? And then did that expanded into, I've written a couple of different OSR games just by taking old games and make my own versions of them. And then also the OSR handbook, where I profile a bunch of different systems. And again, that's a lot of looking at this and saying, this is really interesting. What makes it tick?
That's really cool and super appreciated, at least from my end. Because, I mean, I've had like an edition, a copy of the first edition of Dungeons & Dragons for ages, but I've never actually played it. So then I stumbled across Dungeon Raiders, and it kind of gave me the excuse, a very easy to understand condensed version of of essentially first edition. And so I was able to play it with people, and we had a great time.
That's great. I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah, that was very much the idea of Dungeon Raiders, really, was to look at those systems. And obviously, you know, any simplification changes something.
Sure.
But, you know, folks can take that and run it. And I've actually gotten a chance to run first edition since then. And the experience was surprisingly similar. It's tough because it's one of the reasons why I think the OSR is so interesting. You know, back in the day, when they were building this stuff, they were really hacking together different systems. And, the original couple versions of D&D, really 0th and 1st, were people saying, hey, this thing, you know, this whole role-playing thing is really neat. What systems do we need for that? And I don't mean to suggest that it was just all a bunch of people, you know, throwing things into a hat and seeing what happens. But it was very experimental.
Yeah, and it was an evolution of sorts, too, from the old wargaming stuff. From what I've read, I wasn't there.
No, exactly. And it was figuring out how to do this and what it would look like and what was the easiest way. And that was the other weird thing is, you know, it grew out of these little wargaming groups. And you know, you have rules that work great for those 10 people. But then you publish that as a set of rules and what makes sense for the average person out in Topeka.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of the neat things about the OSR is it's kind of rediscovering that whole experience of experimenting with a concept and kind of building your own version of it that makes sense for you.
How did you, just really quickly, how did you get into RPG stuff then?
Oh boy. So I was an employee at a startup in the area, and I got to know some of the other geeks in the company. And one of them invited me to their role-playing group. And I hadn't had a chance to really, I didn't know anyone growing up who's into a tabletop role playing. I liked it, but, there's just no one to play with. So I jumped at the chance and, turns out they played a lot of D&D and they were moving out of that. So my first role playing game was a session of Nobilis.
Okay.
Which is a very, very flexible, very, loosey-goosey is probably not a bad word for it, but the players are all like avatars of different aspects of reality, and the more specific your aspect, the more control you have over it, and there's all of this mythical stuff going on. It felt very much like somebody, you know, looking at D&D, turning around and going in the exact opposite direction with role-playing. So it was a great experience in that it was very much role-playing. There was basically no combat, but it was really weird wrapping my head around it. And for a first-time role-player, first time with any of these things, it certainly didn't give me a sense of what D&D was like. Then that group we ran for a little while. And then it stopped. And then a few years later, I knew some friends, and I was in my later 20s by this point. I knew some teenagers who were interested in D&D and wanted to play it. And so I volunteered to try to run something D&D like, you know, one of the classic thing of, well, okay, if no one else will DM,
yep,
I'll DM.
Yep.
And,
I know that one.
So exactly. So bought the 3.5 books at the time and played that and was off to the running.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk a little bit about your I kind of recently discovered this. Like initially, I just kind of knew you as someone who was pumping out a bunch of OSR stuff, and then I think probably on Mastodon you had posted a link to your geekarchaeology.com website.
Yeah.
And I realized that every Monday you were making a new monster, and they were amazing. although I have to say my favorite one so far is, I think it was your Thanksgiving special, the villain from MST3K. what's his name? I can't remember his name, but yeah, you know,
Satoris.
Satoris. Yeah. And I love that he can take fire damage, but he continues to burn, taking no damage, but the people around him catch fire as well. It's so perfect.
You know, I was literally watching, it may have been the Turkey Day Marathon, or it was something, and just, you know, I turned around and Satoris came up on the screen, and I was like, holy smokes, that's got to be a D&D villain. I mean, just,
it's brilliant.
Really.
and actually, in a way, I think, in a really strange way, he really exemplifies what you do on Monday monster stuff, because I'm always curious about how does one, and hopefully you have some insight on this, because I think the monsters you create are amazing. So how do you make a monster more than a collection of numbers, of stats?
Yeah, good question. For me, I always start by not thinking about numbers. I start with some concept for a creature, and it's very easy to say that to begin with, and you can do that for the first half dozen monsters or so, and then your creative world runs dry. And once that happens, you really start thinking beyond fantasy, traditional, and not just traditional fantasy, because that's actually a much bigger box. But, you know, if you've run D&D for a while, you start thinking in D&D terms of orcs and goblins and hippogriffs and things like that. You have to really push beyond that to think that, you know, a monster is really just an enemy. It is something that is trying to stop you from doing something. I will think of a monster in terms of, it can just be a guy who has a very particular set of skills, maybe, but it's just a person. And what makes that person unique, you know, for a monster? One of the things that gets me interested, not just in my own creativity, but also what other people, you know, make, is something that's not traditional European fantasy. You know, fantasy is such a big word, and we tend to just really limit that to these very well-worn cliched paths. And, you know, to me, it's like, you know, if you want to do that, there's so many resources to play those things. You know, I really enjoy saying, okay, let's have what would a giant fairy look like? You know, what would something made of crystal, how would that behave? You know, let's get as wild as we can. And then once you have that concept, you then go back to whatever tabletop game you're basing it off of and look at the stats and the abilities and so forth that are available for it, and try to find the materials that fit that concept.
What's the craziest/silliest monster you've ever built that comes to mind?
Craziest/silliest monster I've ever built. Satoris does come to mind.
Right, yeah. Not fair though. We've already yeah, hit that one, so.
Exactly.
I'll give you time to think, and I'll just say that it strikes me sometimes as I sort of flip through a monster manual or bestiary, there's this impression of, oh, this is the good stuff. Like, these are the monsters, right? And then you turn to, like, I'm just looking at page, let's see, 172 of the monster manual, 5th edition, and there's a Grell, which is a brain with a beak and tentacles, you know, and that was their monster, you know, and it's perfectly valid. It's right there in the monster manual.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just basically ridiculous.
Wizards of the Coast does a video series called Lore You Should Know.
Okay.
And it is basically them getting together with some of their internal folks and just saying, okay, here's 30 minutes on, you know, Vecna or on the Sword Coast or whatever.
Nice.
And they did one on evil trees.
Okay.
And they went in and they just are shaking their heads the entire time because they're like, you know what? I went in and I found 37 different kinds of evil trees in D&D. It's just, you know, you name it and it is trying to kill you.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, it's really weird. I would say probably, so I'll give you two answers to the actual question. Okay. The first one was one I built back in October called the Trikaput.
Okay.
And that is a really weird creature because it is a three-headed dinosaur. And it is basically a three-headed dinosaur that is generally just an herbivore, but just it has a, as I, the Trikaput, all 6 tons of it, chooses a mile-wide area of land as its territory and defends it viciously against anything larger than a dog.
Nice, okay.
And just, if you enter its territory, yeah, it will charge you and try to kill you.
Love it, yeah.
It makes these eggs that are very popular as spell components.
Oh,
so of
nice.
Course, guess what's happening?
Yep.
And it's just one of those things where it is, you know, and that was, in a sense, my homage to, okay, let's just have a crazy monster. This doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
The other one would be, and I forget the name of it, I did a, basically a magical woolly mammoth.
Oh, okay.
And this is a creature that is essentially an avatar of winter.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm liking that.
So as, yeah, so you're going through the snowy tundra and you may come across this giant mammoth that has like literally glowing runes on it.
Nice.
And it will turn towards you and you can either talk to it, in which case it might respond. And if you attack it, it's basically like a Tarrasque. Like it is the fundamental force of winter and it will just stomp you to death.
That's fantastic. I'm going to have to look that one up. I must have missed that one. That sounds great. That's very much up my alley. I love the ice creatures. I just love that
nice.
Theme.
Yeah. And that was, again, it's kind of taking an existing monster and saying, okay, we all think about woolly mammoths as just a beast. What if it is this not just calm creature, but this thing that is, you know, literally the essence of a fundamental thing of nature, so that, like, if you know what you're doing going into that monster, you realize, oh my gosh, we can solve all our problems right now.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're a murder hobo, you're in trouble.
Yeah, and well, and why would it occur to you when you see an icy mammoth, mammoth to try to talk to it? So yeah, that's cool.
Exactly.
I love it. A lot of your latest monster, or maybe all of your monsters, I don't know, the ones that I've, since I discovered the feature on your site, have been for 5th edition. Is that because that's sort of a good generic foundation? Is it because it's the most popular? Is it because what you've been playing lately? Is there a rationale behind it?
It's kind of all of those things at once. You know, the fundamental reality is that, you know, D&D drives the tabletop hobby. And especially these days, you know, D&D has such a resurgence, even among pop culture. Just, you know, if you're going to make a thing, if you put it in D&D stats, that gives it the widest audience. I also really like 5th edition. As somebody who has played and enjoyed pretty much every edition of D&D, and a lot of other role-playing games as well, you know, 5th edition also serves just as a good vehicle in terms of like what you were saying. It is it's close enough to previous editions that you can pretty easily adapt it to not only other editions, but also other retro clones and OSR games and things along those lines. So it's kind of a variety of factors. And I also wanted to pick something that was, you know, whatever system it was, whether it be Labyrinth Lord or something else, Osric. I wanted to make sure it was something that was relatively simple enough that it could be used in a bunch of different systems. You know, I did a bunch of stuff back in the day for 4th edition, and I personally love 4th edition D&D, but it just wasn't portable to lots of other different experiences, and that was a problem.
Yeah, that's a nice thing about 5th edition, I think, is that it is, in a weird way, very generic. And you can kind of look at it no matter what system you're playing and pretty easily translate at least the spirit of what the stat block is trying to say.
Exactly. I had a conversation about this on Reddit with somebody about why do they still have the ability scores. Because you don't really use your ability scores anymore. And personally, I think it's for that compatibility with older versions of the game, where you can run second edition, where you sometimes roll a d20 under your stat, and the stat's still there. I think that is backwards compatibility, essentially.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wouldn't be surprised if that's correct. How much influence do you feel, and you may not know, it kind of depends on how dialed in to the scene you were, I guess, but how much of the influence do you think that the open game license had on the gaming world when D&D, or Wizards, I guess, adopted that?
Absolutely massive, and like so many things, it had impacts that no one could have foreseen. One of the interesting things, because I was, you know, like I said, I started with 3.5, and 3.5 had come out maybe a year or two prior.
Okay.
So it was, you know, about midterm into a third edition's life. And so that was the era of splat books, the era of all this material that the Open Game License really helped foster. And on the one hand, it was great because there was a source book for everything. And if you wanted to play a flying lizard man, you could do that. And it was kind of amazing being able to walk into a game store and just seeing shelf after shelf after shelf of books, getting back to that earlier concept of some wild fantasy concepts, all of them completely compatible with your base D&D. On the other hand, you know, my players would come to me and say, okay, I built this thing, and it has a grapple, you know, a plus 23 on all grapples at level 3. And I'd be like, okay. And then, you know, in my early DMing thought, I was like, oh, okay, we'll make that work, without realizing that what he was saying is, I want to grapple things all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that turned into that thing. So, and I think it's interesting because I certainly would not want to go back to a day without an OGL or without kind of, you know, a similar license that D&D has now, where it is certainly possible to create content for that. But it's interesting seeing the impact that had, where it just really opened the floodgates. And I think it was ultimately certainly a helpful thing for the hobby, just not necessarily a helpful thing for Wizards at the time. And that's just kind of the reality of things, where it was. What was also interesting too about that is that from what I've read, and I don't have a lot of knowledge of this prior to what was happening, but nobody had really done that before. Certainly no one as big as D&D. So I think that really changed a lot of people's thoughts about what you could do, where there's a very clear demarcation line where before that, if you made a tabletop role-playing game, you expected folks might make their own private hacks of it and so forth, but that was very much your sort of corporate product. Post that, it was much easier for people to envision and to build their games from the ground up to provide that more free opportunity for people to actually build stuff with their game, because they saw, oh wow, if we harness the crowd, some really interesting things can be made.
Yeah, and I think they were probably, they may not have known it at the time, but it seems like maybe they were playing a long game, pardon any perceived pun there, but I mean, because I mean, it may have caused sort of a, I guess, a disrupt, you know, sort of disrupted things. But now, as you say, it seems like D&D has come full circle and is just so popular right now that I think that investment that they made in just kind of building a community with open content really has come back and paid off.
Totally. And in fact, there's some videos with the lead designers of 5th edition where they talk about how they went through a lot of internal soul searching around just what D&D was when they were building 5th edition, because D&D is the one role-playing game that has the advantage that they can send out surveys and find out how tens of thousands of people are actually playing their game.
Yeah.
So they did that, and they found out that D&D is not a rule system. It is not a specific set of mechanics. Everyone plays D&D differently. People ignore these rules and add these rules,
right.
And they realize it is actually this shared storytelling context that has these certain assumptions built into it, where you roll a 20-sided die, and there's an armor class, and there's, you know, these six core attributes. But beyond that, it gets really fuzzy really quickly. And I think that's why one of the reasons they've been able to be so successful recently is realizing that they can embrace that open nature of the game. They can say, hey, yeah, build stuff. It is amazing to me that Hasbro essentially allowed the creation of the DMs Guild, which is a site where anyone can upload their own D&D content, and it is quote unquote official. Wow.
Yeah.
And it has all of the classic problems of that, but that is such a huge part of the health of this community, is that there are now these options that even the official creators are totally happy with.
It's just such a pleasure to see, to just go through DM's Guild and discover all kinds of cool things. It's just a benefit for everyone.
Totally, totally.
Okay, so I keep flipping back and forth between creative stuff and then just boring licensing stuff. So let's go back to the creative stuff. Where do your ideas for some of your monsters or the factions that you've been working on sometimes, where do these come from? I know that like MST3K obviously just inspired you at one time. Or the weather, I think you mentioned on one of your ice beasts, was like you were like, it's cold outside, let's create an ice swarm or something like that. But where do you get your ideas from?
There's a woman named Marge Tillman in Idaho, and every week she emails me a package which contains all my ideas.
I gotta get her address off air.
we'll make that happen. It comes from a lot of different places. Like I said, I'm a big fan of anime and manga.
Yeah.
And one of the big advantages of that is you get some really neat, weird ideas.
Totally crazy out there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'm going to steal one as a kind of a preview of things to come. There's a manga where this alien creature takes over a teenage girl's body, and can completely transform her physically.
Okay.
Without her knowledge or consent, but can speak to her internally and basically says, look, I don't want to be a jerk about this. Are you okay with this? And she says kind of no. And he goes, well, if we don't do this, monsters are going to hunt us down and kill us. So she's like, well, okay, I guess we're going to have to do that. But she then has to experience all of these horrific monster battles.
Yeah.
Which she just doesn't want to be part of and is very traumatic for her. So you get those sorts of ideas where you can build some interesting twists around those.
Yeah.
Just interesting ideas around
That's almost a warlock.
Yes.
An unwilling warlock almost. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really crazy. It's almost a subclass waiting to happen.
Yeah, totally, totally. Ooh, I might do that.
I always thought would be a fun monster is one modeled after I don't know if you've seen this, you probably have if you're an anime nerd, but Ranma 1/2. Where he switches genders whenever water hits him or her. I think that would be hilarious. Like some kind of monster that would switch some form just by some tiny little external force.
That would be great. Maybe every time it's hit by every time it's hit by an attack.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
you know,
it changes.
Its head disappears.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Boop, boop, boop.
Yeah, but go on. Your ideas.
No, that's really cool. So there's that. There's also like I like watching cheesy old 80s movies.
Yeah.
And you can get some really interesting ideas from that. Again, monsters. And also just taking those and shifting them around. You know, creativity is so often just a matter of bashing two existing things together.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned the frost gulls from a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And that was just, I think I literally came across an image on Flickr of some seagulls, and it was cold outside, and I was like, huh, what if you made, wouldn't scavengers find a cold aura really useful? And, it goes from there. So it's a whole variety of things. The other thing is that I've started, now that I actually have a lot of monsters and factions, I started kind of theming them, where I think about I'll invent, for example, a coastal city, and then when I say invent, I mean literally just my mind. I'll think, what if there's a coastal city? And then I'll think, okay, what creatures might be around there? What factions might be working inside that city? What might the big enemies be? And I'll kind of use that as a springboard to start designing creatures, and I can get a few ideas out of that.
If you let yourself go down a path, like if you just say, okay, I'm gonna, here's this little corner of this world, I mean, you have to just realize in real life there's an ecosystem everywhere you turn, and the deeper you look, the deeper it goes. So it's just, it kind of builds upon itself, I guess.
Exactly. And it helps to think up locations that have, you know, one weird twist. Where, you know, this mine is flooded with radioactive water, right? Okay, what does that do to the ecology? What creatures would have already been there? What might that do to the creatures? Where might they go as a result? What would leave? What would feed on what? And you know, like you say, you can really go from there.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great idea. So just considering, again, just kind of external forces that may have invaded, or an invasive species or whatever. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, totally.
So what kind of campaign setting do you typically run for yourself, or do you just jump to whatever you want?
It varies a lot. My current game is run in kind of in the Forgotten Realms, because my group was just like, you know what, let's just do a straight up Forgotten Realm. None of us had ever played in Forgotten Realms.
Oh, okay.
Before.
Yeah.
So this was kind of that experience for us. Before that, it was actually a custom built setting where myself and the players got together on several different occasions and just spent the time world building.
Ah, cool.
And yeah, so we spent probably 8 or 9 hours all told coming up with concepts and the background of the history and the different countries that were in play and why they disliked each other and all that fun stuff. And that was really cool and fun because we could really tailor that to stuff that we all got our, you know, our juice out of. And I generally tend towards settings that I have done something with.
Right.
Simply because that's more exciting to me. And you know, I think Eberron is fascinating, but I have a tough time wrapping my head around all the different elements of Eberron. While I can go and build something myself, it's certainly not as complicated as Eberron, but is as exciting for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things about pre-existing settings is that there's a time and mental investment in getting to know that setting. And if you're not already familiar with it, then at some point it just kind of makes sense almost to build your own, because in building, you will then become familiar with it.
Yeah. And on the other side of that coin, because I used to be almost sort of anti-established settings, bigoted. I was just like, no, I'd never do that. And now that I've had a chance to actually play in the Forgotten Realms, I get to see it from the other side. Once you make that investment, you know, you want an artifact,
it's there.
You want a faction, everything is
totally
there. It's a Google away, and everything is just kind of there for you. And that makes it so much easier for the DM.
It is nice, yeah. How much world building have you done? I mean, you said that you've done one for that specific campaign. Is that something that you kind of is? Do you see? I mean, the Monster Monday thing, I guess, is sort of world building, but it's very specific. So, yeah, how much world building have you done?
I've done a fair amount. A couple of years ago, I wrote a novel set in a custom world of airship pirates.
Oh, cool!
And
okay.
Did a lot of world building for that. That was a fun one.
Is that on your where do you keep your novels? Where do you sell those or whatever?
That novel is incomplete. When I say written, not done.
Okay.
Because, and this is another interesting thing, I've always liked writing. I've ever since I wrote that. You know, we all had that bad teen fantasy novel we wrote when we were 14.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And you know, the problem is there's a big difference between world building and all that kind of stuff and structuring a novel.
And actually, yep.
So you know, I have it's on, I think, the second draft, but it needs work. But yeah, so you know, world building.
You've got
that.
One person who would love to read that if it ever happens. Just there may be more, but I'm speaking for myself.
Well, thank
I
you.
Would absolutely love that.
All right, you may have just signed up as a beta reader.
Yeah, there you go.
So there's that, and then you know, I've done, gosh, probably half a dozen campaigns that have lasted for you know more than a few sessions, and pretty much all of those have been in custom worlds. I did one set in a Forgotten Realms-ish world, but with its own factions and cities and so forth. I've done some, I did one inspired by Cowboy Bebop,
oh,
the
cool.
anime series, and a few others like that. One inspired by Greek fantasy, but kind of reworking all of the actual geography.
Okay.
So, it really depends. Yeah, usually if I set out to do a long-running campaign, I'm probably going to do something that I've built by myself to some extent.
That might be all of the burning questions that I had for you. And I know that you have a show of your own that you actually do, which again, I just found out about when I invited you onto my show. So I'll probably start watching some of your shows now. Where can people find you? Where do you hang out?
The best place to find me is at Geek Archaeology. Just type it into Google because no one can spell it, even me most of the time.
Thank you very much for talking to me. It's been a real pleasure hearing about all the stuff that you do and your process. That was Brent Newhall. And once again, his site is geekarchaeology.com. Check it out for Monster Monday, where he creates a new monster on Mondays, and Faction Friday, when, at least so far, lately, he's been doing a new faction out of subclasses revealed in Xanathar's Guide to Everything for 5th edition. I think it might be kind of interesting to just review one of his factions, because, I mean, I do a lot of monster stats in other episodes, so while his Monster Monday feature is the thing that started drawing me to Geek Archaeology, I don't want to just relay yet another stat block on this episode, because you hear that a lot in other shows. So this, I think, factions is kind of an interesting angle, and the idea of making a faction out of each subclass, the new subclasses from Xanathar's Guide, I thought was kind of simultaneously really, really an obvious thing and really, really brilliant, because it's just one of those things that, while so obvious, it just never would have occurred to me. So that was kind of cool. So his latest one, as of this recording anyway, is a faction called Those Who Walk Between. And this is a subclass that grew from the Rangers subclass, again, from Xanathar's Guide. So this isn't in Player's Handbook. This is from the add-on book, Xanathar's Guide to Everything. And it is, there was this Ranger subclass called the Horizon Walker. And this is a really interesting one that kind of drew my attention, because I love the, and I think a lot of people love the idea of plane walkers, I guess, you know, people who traverse the plains, and for that person to be a ranger is kind of cool. That seems really, really neat. But it also seems really, really almost like a poor fit. Like, why would a ranger who we typically, I think, bind to nature and to a very specific kind of ecosystem on an Earth-like planet, how can they be horizon walkers, plane, you know, crossing the plains? Well, like, how does that make sense? And making a faction, actually, I found, gives you a great excuse to make that work. So this faction, they call themselves, this is just straight from Geek Archaeology, they call themselves Those Who Walk Between. Heavily cloaked and nearly always wielding staves or other pike weapons, these mysterious entities will stay overnight at a tavern in one country, then appear at a farmhouse hundreds of miles away the next day. Most are quiet types, but some open up to those who bribe them with a good drink or three, and tell stories of wild adventures on other worlds and realms of existence. Those who walk keep tabs on the many portals that dot the multiverse and follow up on reports of new ones. They both discreetly check an official teleportation circles on official teleportation circles to ensure they're stable and ensure that out-of-the-way portals haven't been claimed by nefarious forces or destroyed. How do they have time to do this? An even more mysterious group of ancient wizards who call themselves the Onlookers fund Those Who Walk Between. Each member of the latter group occasionally meets with one or another of the Onlookers to receive payment and leads on unmapped portals. As a friendly faction, a member of Those Who Walk Between might seek out your party and become its patron, handing out portal-related quests, such as finding an abandoned portal, activating a portal recently found, or wiping out a group of enemies who've claimed a portal site of their own. Those Who Walk can also serve as temporary allies in a particular story arc, appearing in a time of crisis to offer aid to a particular faction. as a faux faction, those who walk between see portals as dangerous technology that should be kept away from mortals. They lay traps, set up guardians, and put invisibility spells around any portal they protect. If the PCs find and use an out-of-the-way portal, they may find themselves attacked by one of those who walk, or by assassins sent by them. So that, and then he gives, in the same post, he gives a couple of different plot hooks, but frankly, I think his descriptions of the friendly faction versus the foe faction actually gives plenty of plot hooks sort of inherently. The idea that a quest could be as simple as, well, find this portal, or activate this portal, or protect this portal, or whatever, and not really about, like, okay, we'll go through the portal and cross into another plane, and then your game changes. And I think that's, some people don't maybe realize, they don't see how that subclass of the Ranger could necessarily work in most games, because, I mean, unless you're playing a game about different planes, maybe that wouldn't work for you, saying, okay, my Ranger is a Horizon Walker Ranger, and he's going to jump between planes all the time, and it's like, well, that doesn't really fit in our game. Well, it doesn't really have to. It could be something about portals rather than something through portals, and the same goes for the foe factions. I mean, it could be something about a portal, something, you're too close to a portal, or you're doing something near a portal, or you've accidentally taken an important rune or key to a portal when you found that random, seemingly random stash of treasure, and so on. So really, really great idea, and just a really great little riff on something that exists in the open game license, and that people don't necessarily know what to do with, maybe, and it's one of those things that just, it explains things, it expounds on things, it opens up new ideas, and it's inspiring, is what it is. So there you go. That's the kind of thing that you find on Geek Archaeology. You should go to that site, you should subscribe to the RSS feed, and keep tabs on it, because it is well, well worth it. And when I say RSS feed, of course I mean Atom feed, because of course Brent Newhall has an Atom feed rather than RSS. Apparently this guy is a serious geek and knows what's what. So, anyway, that is the show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Check out Brent Newhall's work, and his story ideas, and all of the cool things that he's creating, and thank you very much for listening. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.